We are continuing in the book of Esther. So if you have a Bible, Esther chapter 9, starting in verse 1, and chapter 10, and there's only three verses in chapter 10, but we are concluding our series this morning in the book of Esther. The Esthers are coming down aisles with Bibles, so if you need one, slip a hand up. You can borrow one this morning. As I always say, keep it if you need one at home, take it home with you. But Esther chapter 9 through 10:3. I won't be reading all of the verses, and so I'll pull out some takeaways for us this morning. The book of Esther is a biblical story of a Jewish woman who becomes queen of Persia. God uses Esther in a position in the palace to rescue the people, to rescue God's people. And the king then hosts this party, 180-day party, orders his queen Vashti to pray before the men. She refuses. The king deposes her, and he seeks a new queen. And there's this beauty pageant that goes on, this contest, and Esther, who is a Jewish woman, enters the contest, and she wins. Esther keeps her Jewish identity kind of a secret for the time being, and Mordecai undercovers this plot to assassinate the king, and he reports it in saving Xerxes' life, the king's life. Haman is promoted to second in charge. He demands everyone to bow down to him. Because of Mordecai's refusal, out of anger, Haman decides to destroy all of the Jews, an entire empire. And he convinces the king, Xerxes, to issue this decree ordering the annihilation of the Jews on a specific date, casting lots to determine what date that would be. And the decree is sent out throughout the entire empire. Upon hearing the decree, Mordecai publicly mourns for his people. And the Jews in Susa, they fast and mourn as well. And he urges Esther, use your royal position to save the Jews. Initially hesitant, Esther is persuaded by Mordecai's words, right? When he said earlier, he said, who knows but that you have become to your royal position for such a time as this. And Esther approaches the king, who promises to grant her request. She hosts two banquets for the king and Haman. At the second banquet, Esther reveals her Jewish heritage and Haman's plot to annihilate her people. Enraged, King Xerxes executes Haman on his gallows. King Xerxes gives Esther his estate and promotes Mordecai to this very high position with lots of power. And despite Esther's plea to reverse this decree against the Jews, King Xerxes allows Mordecai to issue a new decree permitting the Jews to defend themselves. The Jews gather, they arm themselves and fight back on the day of their destruction, ultimately defeating their enemies. These chapters pave the way for the deliverance of the Jewish people in Persia, culminating in the celebration of the Feast of Purim. Today we'll be looking at the final two chapters of this series. Esther 9 is kind of this front row seat, allowing us to witness how God can turn situations of severe adversity into astounding victory. Maybe you've experienced that in your own life. We're reminded that even in the face of enormous difficulties, hope and deliverance is possible. And as you will see, it's also an invitation for us to celebrate life with joy, with generosity, with gratitude, knowing that we are blessed and His mercies are new every morning. Verses 1 through 4, seek the will of God. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities, and all the provinces of King Xerxes attacked those determined to destroy them. No one could stand against them, because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. And listen to this, and all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews, because fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai was prominent in the palace. His reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. You might remember that there were two decrees. The first one, initiated by Haman and approved by the king, was a plan of pinpointing a very specific day and this mass extermination of the Jews would happen. But there was a second decree that was initiated by Esther and approved by the king again. A decree that granted permission for the Jews, they could band together, they could fight together, they could stand together. and kill anyone who originally was planning to kill them. Through a series of providential acts of God, Haman's plan, it was countered by Esther's plan. Her decree didn't replace Haman's. Remember that once a decree was put into motion, it couldn't be reversed. It couldn't be taken away. It was to replace Haman's. It was just to neutralize it, allowing both decrees at the same time to be active and in motion at the same time. Keep in mind, the Jews, after hearing about Haman's plan, had been preparing themselves for 8 months. All the governors, the officials, the satraps support the Jews and stand out of their way because they're afraid of Mordecai, who was now extremely powerful. The Jews kill over 500 people in the citadel of Susa and kill every one of Haman's sons, his 10 sons. But unlike their enemies were accustomed to, they did not plunder their wealth after they killed them. And I think that's a phrase we've got to hang on to this morning. The king, after hearing about all that was happening, asked Esther, "What else do you want me to do?" Listen to this. She says that the Jews should be allowed to keep killing their enemies for another day, and that Haman's 10 sons' corpse should be hanged from the gallows. The king agrees, and the Jews kill 300 more people and hang Haman's sons. While all of this was happening in the capital city of Susa, where Esther lived and Mordecai was at, throughout all the other provinces, the Jews have killed over 75,000 of their enemies. They then rest and celebrate on the following day. How did this complete reversal of circumstances happen? What originated as one extreme, let's kill all of the Jews, swung completely the opposite extreme, the Jews given permission to take a stand against their enemies. How did it happen? It required a king and all of his resources. With the king for them, it didn't matter who was against them. And many of the once enemy of the Jews began to witness right before their own eyes the God of the Jews. They went from being intimidating to intrigued, wondering, who exactly is this God that you worship and that you trust in? Who is this God who is by all accounts on your side? This chapter kind of raises, I think, at least one particular question. Why all the killing and even an extra day to kill even more? Again, we see a connection to an event that took place 500 years earlier. God never forgets. Esther chapter 9 is the antithesis of 1 Samuel 15, when King Saul failed to do what God had asked him to do. And that was to kill King Agag and all the Amalekites. Instead, he kept the king alive and he plundered all of their goods. King Saul's disobedience 500 years earlier led to the loss of the throne and the anointing upon his life. Eventually, his continued disobedience led to he himself, his army, and even his sons, everybody being killed in his family. God's protection was removed from Saul because of his self-pride and disobedience. So Esther chapter 9 suddenly becomes more than just God's favor on Mordecai and on Esther in the moment. It's actually the fulfillment of what he intended to have happen 500 years earlier. The death of Haman, the Agagite, who was a descendant of the Amalekites, brought fulfillment to God's plan to remove evil opposition. We have our own enemies to deal with. And there's one in particular, the evil one. The scripture tells us that he's come to steal, kill, and destroy. He's come to steal, kill, and destroy your life. He's come to steal, kill, and destroy your marriage, everything about you. We have our own enemies to deal with, of which God is fully aware. But just like Esther, with the King of Kings on our side, we have no reason to fear. Romans 8:31 says this, "What then shall we say in response to these things? If God is for us," what's the rest of it say? "Who can be against us?" The phrase "these things" in Romans 8:31, it says, "What then shall we say in response to these things?" The phrase "these things" in Romans 8:31 points us back to the many amazing proofs of God's unfailing love. What then shall we say in response to all of the amazing proofs of God's love toward us? If God is for us, who can be against us? The truth of Romans 8:31 offers a promise. Because of the purpose God has placed within you, the only way you will experience defeat is when you surrender. Some of you right now are experiencing the weight of trials of this life. Some of you right now are experiencing the challenges of this life. Uncertain when the valley will give way to green pasture. His omniscience tells us that he's aware because he's all-knowing. His omnipresence tells us that he cares. His omnipotence tells us that he can be trusted because he's all-powerful. For God to be God, his three attributes must be interdependent. If you remove any one of the three, the other two fall short. It collapses. Imagine God is fully aware, but he lacks the power. Or imagine if God were all-powerful, but he lacked the knowledge. Or if he had all power, but he can only be in one place at one time. Our hope of God being for us rests solely upon the all-embracing sovereignty of God, the great I Am. Verses 5 through 15, experience the victory of God. The Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. In the citadel of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. To make sense of what we are reading here in chapter 9 and elsewhere in the book of Esther, and for that matter throughout the Old Testament, we have to cling to a word to make sense of it all. The word is enemy. In every instance where God allowed for such slaughter, there were limits. It wasn't like this free-for-all. There's always given specific instruction as to who, why, and when. So in this case, they were enemies of the Jews and even hated the Jews. But listen to this, only those who were forthright about their hate for the Jews were killed. Not all of those who were living in Susa were killed. Only those who hated the Jews and made it known. Verse 11, the number of those killed in the citadel of Susa was reported to the king that same day. And the king said to Queen Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in the citadel of Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your petition? It will be given to you. What is your request? It will be granted." There's also this very specific mention of the death of Haman's 10 sons, the member that she'd asked for, and their impalement upon these poles. In chapter 5, Haman boasted about his sons, and now we are seeing their destruction. Their hate for the Jews bound them together. And what bound them together took them down together. I think we would all agree that trying to figure out King Xerxes is nearly impossible. He's the most powerful man in the world at this time, and he does what he wants when he wants. Why he would even give Esther another blank check offer seems irrational, but he did. And Esther's response again says this, verse 13, "If it pleases the king," Esther answered, "give the Jews in Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow also, and let Haman's 10 sons be impaled on the poles." If it pleases the king, Esther answered, give the Jews another day to finish the job and put this cherry on the top, so to speak, and hang Haman's 10 sons on the gallows, but only if it pleases the king. What does this tell us? Esther felt there were still others who posed a threat to the Jews. The job wasn't finished. In addition, a public display of Haman's sons on the gallows would send this loud and clear message to everyone: don't mess with God. And don't mess with God's people. Verse 14 and 15, so the king commanded that this be done. An edict was issued in Susa, and they impaled the 10 sons of Haman. And the Jews in Susa came together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they put to death in Susa 300 men. But listen to this. This is the second time this phrase is mentioned, and it's mentioned three times. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder. So with the king's permission, in Susa alone, on the first day, 500 killed, his 10 sons killed. On the second day, another 300 were destroyed, but that again was just in the capital. 16, meanwhile, the remainder of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also assembled to protect themselves and get relief from their enemies. They killed 75,000 of them, third time, but did not lay their hand on the plunder. So while all of this was taking place in Susa, across the Persian Empire, Jews had joined hands to protect themselves and stand against their enemies. I think one of the takeaways here is to note the fact that they assembled. They stood against their enemies together, not alone. An individual fights alone, but an army fights together. That is why we hold each other's arms in the air. That's why we carry each other's burdens. That's why we stand in the gap for other people who say, can you pray for me? Yes, I'll be standing in the gap for you. That's why we come alongside people and help. That's why we come alongside people and encourage. Because an army fights together. Beyond Susa, this 75,000 enemies were killed, but did not lay their hands on the plunder. What's the big deal about plunder? There's an idolatrous kind of plundering that the people of God are never to engage in. And that is exactly what was before them, and they denied it. Again, remember back in 1 Samuel 15 of King Saul, he failed as a king and was rejected as the king by God for what? Idolatrous plundering. He had defeated his Amalekite enemies and had been instructed by God to not leave anything alive, not to touch the spoil, but to devote all of it as a burnt offering to the Lord. And what did he do instead? He failed. He left Agag alive, the king. He preserved the best of the spoil. What was at the heart of that sin? Idolatry. It was rejection of God in favor of the spoil, which is idolatrous plundering. In this passage, by leaving the plunder, the Jews demonstrated this self-denial and communicated to the non-Jews that this killing was not motivated by greed. Idolatry is the worship of idols. Maybe we can apply some of this. The worship of someone or something other than God as though they are God. It is anything that we replace God with. That's why we need to check our heart often and ask, is there anything I'm putting before God as though it were God? That could be a pursuit, a person, that could be a bank account, an activity, an addiction, many, many different things. Whatever we believe that will satisfy us, that'll make us happy, that'll ease our anxiety, listen, is at risk of being an idol. Verse 17, this happened on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. The Jews in the provinces rested and celebrated their victory on the 14th day of Adar, feasting, joyful. Meanwhile, those in Susa rest on the 15th day, following 2 days of killing their enemies, and they also made it a day of feasting and joy. So it ended up that there's 2 days of feasting and joy. Number three, celebrate the goodness of God, verses 18 through 32. The Jews in Susa, however, had assembled on the 13th and 14th, and then on the 15th, they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. That is why rural Jews, those living in the villages, observed the 14th of the month of Adar as a day of joy and feasting, a day for giving presents to one another. Kind of reminds me of Christmas. So what is the how, the who, and the why behind Purim? And why is it important for us to know this holiday, this feasting, this joy? Well, first, the how. Today, Jews, other than those who live in Jerusalem, celebrate Purim on the 14th, and those in Jerusalem celebrate on the 15th. Purim is this celebration. It's a day of feasting and joy and a day of giving presents to one another. What did they and do they celebrate? What are they celebrating? They celebrated what God had done. God wants his people to celebrate all that he does for them. So the Jewish calendar is chock full of holy days so his people would remember what he did for them. What a great reminder for all of God's children, whether a believing Jew or any other believer for that matter, as we approach Christmas. Rather than pack every minute full of things to do, we're invited to celebrate what God has done. Sending his son to this earth to be born of a baby, Emmanuel, God with us. Second, the who, verses 20 through 22. Mordecai recorded these events and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and the 15th days of the month of Adar as the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies and as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. Mordecai is actually the one who kind of initiated this holy celebration, this Purim, and insisted that it become this annual celebration. He sent all these letters throughout the empire, encouraging them to celebrate, to not forget what God has done. What about the why? Verses 23. So the Jews agreed to continue the celebration they had begun, doing what Mordecai had written to them. It's a reminder for us to remember and celebrate what God did and has done. Do you remember what happened right after the Israelites were freed from Egypt? He gave them a holiday called Passover so that every year they would remember the faithful hand of God. Right after the Israelites passed through the Jordan River, he had them go back and set up 12 stones and build this memorial so that the future generations would see them and remember the miraculous deliverance. Jesus said regarding communion, do this in remembrance of me. We remember much better when something becomes a part of a normal rhythm. Not only the repetition, but also the recounting of God's faithfulness. God knows that we're prone to forget, and aging doesn't help that matter, right? An indication of age is how many times you have to say, what was I just saying? Do you do that? Verse 29, so Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, along with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm the second letter concerning Purim. The Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews in the 127 provinces of Xerxes' kingdom, words of goodwill and assurance to establish these days of Purim at their designated times, as Mordecai and the Jew and the Queen Esther had decreed for them, and as they had established for themselves and their descendants in regard to their times of fasting. Esther's decree confirmed these regulations about Purim, and it was written down in the records. The reason Purim has its name is because of the word pur means the lot. It means to gamble, in a sense, like gambling. Since Haman, you remember, cast lots to determine, it's kind of like rolling dice, which day should we have the Jews annihilated on? But instead, what we're seeing here is the lot was reversed against them. He determined the days of his own destruction. Purim is this visual reminder to a sinful watching world that he will have the final word. In Noah's day, it was the flood. In Moses' day, he parted the Red Sea. In David's day, he caused the giant to fall. In Esther's day, he turned a near Holocaust into a great day of celebrating. Fourth, chapter 10, 1 through 3. Notice the favor of God. King Xerxes imposed tribute throughout the empire to its distant shores, and all his acts of power and might, together with a full account of the greatness of Mordecai, whom the king had promoted, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Media and Persia? Mordecai, the Jew, was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews and held in high esteem by many Jews, because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for their welfare of all the Jews. Here's some key takeaways to the entire book and to this chapter. When God makes a promise, he keeps it. When God delivers his people, it's time to celebrate. We have been delivered through Christ. Don't miss the favor of God because you're distracted by substitutes. Like the little boy who was playing in mud puddles said no to an invitation to go to the ocean because he had never seen it. Don't settle for mud puddles. God wants to show you the ocean. When we celebrate God's faithfulness in the past, we're filled with hope of his favor for the future. When we depend on man, we only get what man can do. When we depend on God, we only get what God can do. Here's the one thing. Remembering you are blessed leads to rest. Forgetting that you are blessed leads to stress. And two verses in Lamentations. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Jews celebrate Purim to remember God's physical rescue. We celebrate Christmas to remember God's spiritual rescue.